Iran once again rules out any renegotiation of the 2015 nuclear deal, calling on the U.S. to return to the accord and lift anti-Tehran sanctions. Russia accuses the U.S. Embassy in Moscow of fueling demonstrations in support of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Also in the headlines, people take to the streets in the Tunisian capital to protest against inequality and police brutality, defying a ban on demonstrations. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Iran's foreign ministry has ruled out any renegotiation of the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said there will be no JCPOA plus, no new agreement, and no new talks about the 2015 agreement. He noted that Tehran has no interest in any direct contact with Washington. Araghchi said the Islamic Republic believes the JCPOA is the right framework for dialogue. The Iranian official said the new U.S. administration should make up for the mistakes of the previous one and return to the nuclear deal and lift sanctions. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 despite opposition from the other signatories and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Political commentator David Yahoubian says Iran's enemies will continue to try their utmost to maintain some pressure on Tehran during the new U.S. administration.
There is all sorts of flack and pressure being applied by the usual suspects, by the Israel lobby, by the Saudi and Gulf lobbies, and the general pressure by way of the usual actors and spokespeople of the military-industrial complex to maintain some sort of quote-unquote pressure on Iran. It takes some time for reality to sink in with those who maintain an imperial mindset, although I do think that Iran's sticking to its very principled approach to the JCPOA and repeating facts is necessary to push American political elites past this psychological barrier that they seem to maintain.
At least 11 members of Iraq's popular mobilization units are killed in a terrorist attack in the central province of Salahuddin. Security sources say 10 others were all wounded in the attack, which they blamed on Daesh terrorists. The assailants used light weapons and the cover of darkness to ambush the PMU's 22nd Brigade east of the city of Tikrit. The attack comes 2 days after the terrorist killed 32 people in a twin suicide bombing in the capital, Baghdad. Daesh once again, or actually I should say Daesh, began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swaths of the country. Baghdad declares victory over the terrorists in 2017, or declared that following an intense military campaign in which the PMU played a key role. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says the U.S. hasn't assisted the Iraqi forces in their fight against terrorism.
Well, obviously it's ISIS, and it was ISIS last week with the 32 dead. So this really looks like a call to arms on part of ISIS against Biden. It's giving him the heads up that they are still strong, and that the U.S. troops really don't do anything to improve the situation. So the PMU was vital to fighting them, and they should play an important role continuing today. Trump was very bad on this. He was clearly not doing anything to seriously fight ISIS. He was focused on Iran and making Israel happy.
Three civilians have been killed and seven others injured in an artillery attack near the northern Syrian city of Aleppo. One woman and two children were killed in the shelling carried out by Turkish military forces and their allied militants. The targeted regions are controlled by Kurdish fighters. Turkish-backed militants have conducted similar attacks on the area in the past. In December of 2019, 11 civilians, including 8 children, were killed by militants' mortar fire. The new U.S. administration says it'll review the peace agreement Washington reached with the Taliban last year. President Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, says the U.S. wants to check whether the militant group is committed to reducing violence. In our news review program, we discuss that issue with our guests.
Hello and welcome to this hour's news review. Now, the new U.S. administration says it will review the peace agreement Washington reached with the Taliban last year. President Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, informed his Afghan counterpart, Hamdullah Mohib, about the review in a phone call. Sullivan told him that the U.S. wants to check whether the militant group is living up to its commitments to reduce violence. He said the U.S. will support the peace process in Afghanistan for a permanent ceasefire. Under the deal between the U.S. and the Taliban, all American forces will leave Afghanistan by May. Now, the Taliban have pledged not to engage in violence. However, the group continues its attacks, including on government forces. Well, joining me to discuss this issue from Westchester, Lawrence Davidson, a former lecturer at Westchester University. And out of Brussels, Elijah McNeil, journalist and political analyst. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Lawrence. Where does this deal stand, you think, with the new U.S. administration now? Although there are some hints that Washington will abide by the previous agreement, but there's no certainty with that. What do you think?
Well, it's a no-win situation for Washington. The Taliban must know that that the Americans will not recommit more troops. That's almost certainly the case, that they won't go back with more troops, and that they won't be there forever. So it's a matter of waiting the Americans out. Now, surely they can facilitate that withdrawal by, you know, standing down temporarily at least, and not continuing with with attacks. But I'm not sure how strong the Taliban's control is over all of its forces. In other words, it's not a centralized command, as far as I can understand it. And so, essentially, if they want to wait the Americans out, they can do that, and they can facilitate the withdrawal, because the Americans have no way, really, of forcing the Taliban to do anything, because they can't stay there very much longer.
Elijah, your take on this. We've seen these talks take place for a while now, and of course, before we had seen other talks take place. Do you think that this time around it's going to be different, and your overall perspective in dealing with this new U.S. administration?
Indeed, I think the new U.S. administration will not honor the agreement signed by President Trump that the in February 29, 2020 in Doha, because already Antony Blinken said we want to retain some capacity to deal with any resurgence of terrorism, which is what brought us there in the first place. So 20 years ago, the Americans came to Afghanistan, occupied the country, and they are supposed to leave according to the deal with Trump. But by saying we want to return and retain some capacity, it means he wants to retain some U.S. personnel. And in the agreement is extremely clear. It says it's after 14-month period of negotiation, the withdrawal of all military forces of the United States, its allies and coalition partner, including non-diplomatic civilian personnel, private security contractor, trainer, advisor, and everybody should pull out. What the new administration is saying, well, we still need to look at it, and Taliban is really not honoring it. And then Blinken is saying, well, I haven't looked at it properly. So he's telling us he has some information. He doesn't have full access to the deal. In any way, he's going to keep some personnel. It means he's not going to accept the deal as signed by Trump and will retain forces in Afghanistan. And that is not the agreement with the Taliban. And that means the continuous of attack against the U.S. forces.
So, now, Elijah, sorry to interrupt you. So basically what you're saying is that this new government is even more hawkish than the previous government, and that they don't want to actually leave Afghanistan, even after 20 years of being there.
Exactly. They're saying we want to retain some personnel. Of course, they reduced the forces to 2,500. They did the same in Iraq. President Trump promised Prime Minister Kadhimi to pull out more forces before he leaves, and he did not pull out more forces. Biden administration is not going to leave from Iraq, is not going to leave from Afghanistan, and is not pull all the forces, but will retain some forces. It means they retain some control, and this is not an administration that is going to leave the Middle East so easily.
On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on this news review. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer, Westchester University, out of Westchester. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, out of Brussels.
Welcome back. Russia accuses the U.S. Embassy in Moscow of promoting the Saturday protests across the country over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova says the embassy has published routes of planned demonstrations in support of Navalny. She demanded an explanation from American diplomats. Moscow and other cities have seen public protests against the detention. Police clashed with demonstrators who defied a ban on holding rallies in some cities in the Far East and Siberia regions. They called on the Russian government to release Navalny. A monitoring group says over 2,500 people were arrested during the rallies. Last week, Navalny was detained at an airport in Moscow upon arrival from Germany. Political commentator George Samueli believes the United States has a track record at meddling in the internal affairs of other countries, including Russia.
The United States has been interfering in the internal affairs of Russia for a very long time. Well, you remember the 1996 election, which basically the Americans flagrantly interfered and secured the election for Boris Yeltsin. And the Americans boasted about their intervention to get Boris Yeltsin over the finish line. So it's not really payback. But yes, I mean, without question, I mean, this is what the Biden administration will be seeking to do, given who's there. I mean, we're talking about Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, and of course, in the number three position, Victoria Nuland, whom we all remember handing out cookies to the protesters in Kiev. So they unquestionably are targeting Putin's government. It won't succeed, but it will aggravate relations between Russia and the United States, and with the relations are already in a very dire strait. So I think it's bad news for the world when two nuclear superpowers are at such are in such a state of animus.
Tunisians have staged a demonstration in the capital, Tunis, against economic inequality and police brutality in the North African country. Protesters marched across the city in defiance of a ban on public gatherings. They expressed anger at the security forces' use of force against demonstrators. Tunisian youth have been staging protest rallies against the country's political system and soaring unemployment. 10 years into the popular revolt that toppled longtime dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, Tunisia remains grappling with an economic crisis. The situation has been further aggravated by the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States urges China to stop pressuring Taiwan as Washington continues to deepen its ties with the island. In a statement, the U.S. Department urged Beijing to instead engage in meaningful dialogue with Taiwanese officials. This comes after Taiwan and Chinese bombers and jets entered the southwestern corner of its air defense identification zone. Beijing is critical of Washington's deepening ties with the self-ruled island, which China views as part of its territory. The Chinese government has repeatedly called on the United States to abide by the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Tensions between the U.S. and China are at their highest in decades over a host of issues, including Hong Kong and the COVID-19 pandemic. Portugal has registered new records in its daily coronavirus infections and deaths. The European country reported over 15,000 new cases and 274 deaths on Saturday. Overall, it has confirmed nearly 625,000 cases and 10,000 deaths. Portugal has one of the world's highest infection rates, which has put its health system under increasing strain. Germany, meanwhile, has reported over 16,000 new COVID-19 infections and 879 related deaths. According to the Robert Koch Institute, over 2.1 million cases have been confirmed. Death toll in Germany stands at around 52,000. The country has been under lockdown since mid-December. The curbs have been extended until mid-February. In the UK, the government is extending the gap between the first and second Pfizer and BioNTech vaccines up to 12 weeks to give more of its citizens a first dose.
Well, the government's following the very clear advice by the MRSA, our own experts, and from the four chief medical officers of all parts of the United Kingdom. And they said that ensuring that someone is vaccinated for the second jab within 12 weeks is fine, and that's what we're following. And as a result of that, we're ensuring that millions more people can get the first jab and the high level of protection that that provides as quickly as possible.
Senior doctors have challenged the government's decision, saying it is at odds with guidance by the World Health Organization. Britain reported over 1,300 deaths from COVID-19 and more than 33,000 new cases on Saturday. That takes the death toll there above 97,000, with the overall infections topping 1.6 million. Britain has the highest death toll in Europe, followed by Italy. The Italian Health Ministry recorded 488 fatalities and over 13,000 new cases in one day. Italy has registered over 85,000 deaths and almost 2.5 million cases since the beginning of the pandemic. A British pharmaceutical giant is to cut deliveries of the Oxford COVID-19 vaccine to the EU by 60% in the first quarter of the year. AstraZeneca was set to send some 80 million doses of the bloc's member states by the end of March. However, it has informed the EU officials that it can deliver 31 million doses due to production problems. AstraZeneca has not indicated delivery targets for the second quarter. It had initially agreed to deliver more than 80 million doses for the April-June period. The announcement has sparked new concerns over the rollout of inoculations in the bloc. The rollout had already slowed down in some member states after U.S. drug maker Pfizer cut vaccine deliveries by half to the countries.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to NASA estimates, there are at least 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, of which about 4 billion are sun-like. If only 7% of those stars have habitable planets, a seriously conservative estimate, there could be as many as 300 million potentially habitable Earth-like planets out there in the whole Milky Way alone. Ravi Kumar Kaparapu, a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, said, "We want to be very conservative in case nature has any surprises regarding habitability." He added, "So we are lowballing the estimates intentionally. On average, the astronomers calculated the nearest such planet should be about 20 light years away, and there should be 4 of them within 30 light years or so of the Sun." We are prepared for you an article written by Dennis Overby, titled "Looking for Another Earth? Here Are 300 Million Maybe." The article has appeared in the New York Times. Please stay with us for more of Dennis Overby's article. A decade ago, a band of astronomers set out to investigate one of the oldest questions taunting philosophers, scientists, priests, astronomers, mystics, and the rest of the human race. How many more Earths are out there, if any? How many far-flung planets exist that could harbor life as we know it? Their tool was the Kepler spacecraft, which was launched in March of 2009 on a 3.5-year mission to monitor 150,000 stars in a patch of sky in the Milky Way. It looked for tiny dips in starlight caused by an exoplanet passing in front of its home star. When the mission was launched in March of 2009, William Borucki said, "It's not ET, but it's ET home." It was Borucki, an astronomer now retired from NASA's Ames Research Center, who dreamed up of the project and spent 2 decades convincing NASA to do it. Before the spacecraft finally gave out in 2018, it had discovered more than 4,000 candidate worlds among those stars. So far, none have shown any sign of life or habitation. Granted, they're very far away and hard to study. Extrapolated, that figure suggests that there are billions of exoplanets in the Milky Way galaxy, but how many of those are potentially habitable? After crunching Kepler's data for 2 years, a team of 44 astronomers led by Steve Bryson of NASA Ames Research Center has landed on what they say is the definitive answer, at least for now. Their paper has been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. Kepler's formal goal was to measure a number called Eta Earth, the fraction of sun-like stars that have an Earth-sized object orbiting them in the Goldilocks or habitable zone, where it is warm enough for the surface to retain liquid water. The team calculated that at least 1/3 and perhaps as many as 90% of stars similar in mass and brightness to our own sun have rocks like Earth in their habitable zones, with a range reflecting the researchers' confidence in their various methods and assumptions. That is no small bonanza, however you look at it. According to NASA estimates, there are at least 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, of which about 4 billion are sun-like. If only 7% of those stars have habitable planets, a seriously conservative estimate, there could be as many as 300 million potentially habitable Earth-like planets out there in the whole Milky Way galaxy alone. Ravi Kumar Kaparapu, a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and one of the authors of the report, said, "We want to be very conservative in case nature has any surprises regarding habitability." He added, "So we are lowballing the estimates intentionally. On average, astronomers calculated the nearest such planet should be about 20 light years away, and there should be 4 of them within 30 light years or so of our own sun." Natalie Batalha, an astronomer at the University of California at Santa Cruz, who directed the Kepler mission during most of his life and was one of the authors of the new paper, in a triumphant email said, "It took 11 years from launch to publication, but this is it." She added, "This is the science result we've all been waiting for, the reason that Kepler was selected for flight in December of 2001. The new result means that the galaxy is at least twice as fertile as estimated in one of the first analyses of Kepler data in 2013. That finding by Andrew Howard, Eric Petigura, and Jeffrey Marcy, who were not part of the Kepler team, concluded that about one-fifth of sun-like stars harbored planets in their habitable zones. Natalie Batalha said that one improvement this time around was the addition of data from the European Gaia satellite, which has measured the position and brightness of 1 billion stars. The knowledge allowed the Kepler scientists to more precisely chart the habitable zones of their stars. Another improvement was better handling of the statistics, although, as Natalie Batalha noted, surveys are inherently incomplete. You can't call up every citizen. You can't observe every star. In the case of Kepler, the limitation was serious. The spacecraft's orientation system failed before Kepler could complete the primary survey, which limited it to detecting planets that had orbital periods of less than about 700 days, about twice the duration of an Earth year. In an email, David Charbonneau, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, said he was slightly skeptical of the result. "The Kepler mission didn't detect many, arguably any, true Earth analogs, that is, planets with the same radius as Earth and orbiting at the same period, and hence receiving the same amount of light, and orbiting sun-like stars." As Natalie Batalha said at the time, "We don't yet have any planet candidates that are exact analogs of the Earth in terms of size, orbit, and star type. We still don't. As a result, the astronomers had to extrapolate data from the planets that they did see. Although these Kepler planets are Earth-sized, 1.5 the radius of Earth, they are presumably rocky. Nobody knows what they are like in any detail, nor whether anything does or could live on them. They are too far away for further study. So far, we know of only one planet, our own, that harbors life. But there are plenty of opportunities yet to find out. The Kepler measurement of Eta Earth only pertains to stars like the Sun, but in the galaxy those stars are vastly outnumbered by smaller, dimmer stars known as red dwarfs. 1/4 to 1/2 of red dwarfs also harbor habitable zone planets, according to work by Courtney Dressing, now at the University of California, Berkeley, although some astronomers worry that radiation flares from such stars would doom any life trying to get started there. Red dwarf planets were not included in the new analysis of Eta Earth. The red dwarf planets are relevant to the search for life because Kepler has passed the torch to a spacecraft called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, which was launched in 2018 to scour the entire sky for exoplanets within a few hundred light-years of Earth, the local neighborhood. So far, TESS, or the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, has discovered 66 new exoplanets and has cataloged more than 2,000 candidates. George Ricker, an astrophysicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and principal investigator for the mission, in an email said, "Most of those planets were expected to be found circling red dwarfs." He added, "Since about 3/4 of the stars in the solar neighborhood are M dwarfs, that leaves open a very large discovery space for TESS in the decade ahead." Natalie Batalha said that young scientists in the future might yet find a way to improve the value of ITER Earth. Until then, this will be the de facto standard. The value of ITER Earth is an important and hitherto unknown factor in a mathematical expression known as the Drake equation. It is used by astronomers to estimate how many technological civilizations might exist in the galaxy, and that we might be able to contact by radio or other means some cosmic day. It's time to move on to the next factor in the Drake equation for extraterrestrial civilizations, the fraction of these worlds on which life emerges. The search for even a single slime mold on some alien rock would revolutionize biology, and it is a worthy agenda for the next half century as humans continue to climb out of ourselves and into the universe in the endless quest to end our cosmic loneliness.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is what Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, told Muslims after the passing away of her dear father, the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, when she perceived signs of weakness of faith among them. When God perceived the nations divided into different religions, deifying fire and worshipping idols, and rejecting Him in spite of their intellect and knowledge, God the Majestic guided and enlightened them from darkness through my father Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and removed the curtains of ignorance from their hearts, and illuminated their eyes, relieving them from blindness.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند، این ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, on ethics and politics. The most dangerous trap for mankind is their selfishness and egoism. We have to free ourselves from this trap and then follow the right path in order to be able to both correct ourselves and our society. September 11th, 1980.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another episode of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. Until today, we were talking about his viewpoints in regards to the prophets of God. In one of his sayings, he mentions that the prophets came to put these potential forces of man to work, to render man's potential active. Now, what is this potential forces that Imam Khomeini is talking about? These potential forces, as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions in the Quran, that I have created you all on my fitrah, chapter 30, verse 30. This fitrah means that he has potentially created us as a perfect being, as a perfect person. Now, what he wants us to actually and practically become the perfect man or a perfect person. So he sent us in this world, potentially being a perfect person, and after that, using our potentials, these potential forces, we should become actually and practically a perfect person. For example, the kids have the potential to become a doctor or maybe an engineer, maybe a poet, maybe a leader. So he has the potential when he is born. He is born with all these potentials, but actually what he becomes, it depends on his action. It depends on the forces, the potential forces that he actives, that he puts into work.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya
The job of the prophets is to put these potential forces to work and to render man's potential active so that this person who has been created potentially perfect becomes perfect like prophets themselves. The prophets are the masters. The prophets are the teachers. They are those who practically became perfect and they know the path because they have done this path. They've gone through this path. So they know what is the path to reach to the perfection. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent these teachers, these lights, these guides for us, who guide us, who warns us, and who give us the glad tidings too. And they warn us for not to perform the bad deeds. If we do bad deeds, we will not get to the perfection. We will not be using that potential forces that are set into us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that are put into us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, and if they are giving us the glad tidings, it is on the basis of using those potential forces that are put by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to use our potential forces to become perfect inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Authorities are opening a criminal investigation into charges that Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed has been complicit in acts of torture in Yemen. The initial investigation was opened last October after two complaints were filed when bin Zayed visited Paris in 2018. The charges against bin Zayed have been made by the International Coalition for the Defense of Rights and Freedoms, and 6 Yemeni citizens subjected to torture and violence in UAE-run prisons inside their country. The complaint accuses Bin Zayed as commander-in-chief of UAE forces of providing the means and orders for these violations to be carried out. Investigations by Anwatana, a leading Yemeni human rights group, garnered thousands of interviews with ex-detainees who pointed to the UAE and its proxies for the most heinous crimes committed. According to the Anwatana report, detainees are subjected to various forms of torture and inhuman treatment, including but not limited to beating, kicking, burning, waterboarding, hanging, deprivation of water and food, and sexual abuse that could amount to rape and threats of rape. In just one case, one of the victims, according to the report, was put in a large barrel-like hole for 2 days, and his feet and hands were tied up with wire before he was stripped naked and suspended from the ceiling for several hours. He was also subjected to electric shocks and burned with lit cigarettes.
Anyone who disagrees with the unlawful occupation of Saudi-led coalition of the southern provinces end up being unlawfully arrested, detained, tortured, raped, and quite often in these detention centers. And these are very, very serious violations of human rights. And some of these victims weren't even politically active people as such. They just, for example, some of them declined to be recruited as part of Saudi-led coalition forces to fight in the southern borders of the Saudi regime.
So far, a total of 419 cases of arbitrary abusive detentions, 327 enforced disappearances, 141 torture allegations, and 25 deaths in detention have been attributed to the UAE and allied forces, although the real figures might be much higher. Forces backed by the United Arab Emirates, including the Southern Transitional Council, STC, have also been named as abusers in rights groups' reports. In detention centers run by the separatist STC, prisoners are reportedly being subjected to a wide range of torture, such as nail removal, forced nudity, and rape.
I'm originally from a family of southern Yemen, and I can tell you from knowing, having personal knowledge about what is being said about southern provinces, in particular Hadramaut and Aden and Taiz, people are not happy with the unlawful occupation of the Emiratis. Let's just go back to the detention centers itself. Why have they set up these detention centers? They set them up in order to subdue any potential resistance and also to force people into recruitment, into mercenaryhood, to go and fight in Saudi borders.
According to Amnesty International, Abu Dhabi is facilitating the torture, violence, and disappearances in southern Yemen's secretive prisons. Reports in the Associated Press have also revealed that several activists, journalists, and members of the Yemeni Muslim Brotherhood have been detained and grilled on trumped-up charges. Many of these forms of torture, such as sexual violence and stripping personal dignity, may amount to war crimes. Such accusations against the UAE can be tried in France under the universal jurisdiction principle that countries are obliged to investigate war crimes wherever they may have been carried out. But the question of diplomatic immunity for the UAE Crown Prince is still under consideration. Above all, the special relations between Abu Dhabi and Paris make a serious move against Bin Zayed almost impossible. France has a military base in Abu Dhabi, and the United Arab Emirates, still its leading client, purchase 1.5 billion euros worth of French arms in 2019 alone. Moreover, French special forces are on the ground in Yemen, fighting alongside troops from the UAE.
I foresee a situation where a brave judge would can continue the investigation and even declare that there is a case to answer. And I can also foresee a situation where the Macron regime will try to undermine the independence of the judiciary and perhaps exert some sort of political power to try and stop the case from continuing.
To fight the Yemen war, the UAE has also lured foreign mercenaries, including thousands of jobless Sudanese men, promising them jobs in the UAE with enticing salaries. By coincidence, the British law firm Stoke White has also called on the authorities in Britain, the United States, and Turkey to arrest high-ranking Emirati officials for committing war crimes and torture in Yemen. In the words of Hakan Kamuz, head of international law at Stoke White, the case is filed against high-ranking officials in the UAE government and Ministry of Defense, alongside the U.S. mercenaries who have acted under the direct orders of the UAE government. Again, like in the case in France, the question is if the British government will take the case seriously, given the trade relations Britain has with the UAE. Knowing that the Western government will never hazard their economic ties for the sake of humanity, the UAE Crown Prince has overseen war crimes in cold blood since the onset of the Yemen war in 2015.
If we don't uphold human rights at this juncture, and Yemen is a test for the international community on many aspects, particularly in relation to upholding international humanitarian and human rights laws, and it will expose the hypocrisy of countries that claim to uphold these principles, but in practice support regimes that breach them with impunity, routinely, without any accountability.
Hundreds of Yemeni civilians are dreaming of regaining their stolen freedom in the UAE-run prisons, while forces under the command of Mohammed bin Zayed continue to arbitrarily detain, inhumanely disrespect, and brutally torture ordinary people on Yemeni soil.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Humanity's destruction of nature has made an estimated 2 in 5 plant species worldwide at risk of extinction, according to an assessment published recently by the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, in the UK.
Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Global Report Warns Nearly 40% of Plants at Risk of Extinction. Here's the details of this article. Humanity's destruction of nature has made an estimated 2 in 5 plant species worldwide at risk of extinction, according to an assessment published recently by the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew in the UK. The fourth annual report, entitled State of the World's Plants and Fungi, draws on the expertise of 210 researchers from 42 countries for what Professor Alexander Antonelli, Director of Science at RBGQ, calls an unparalleled collaborative effort that aims to put the planet and all its inhabitants on a more sustainable path. Open your fridge, peek into your medicine cupboard, examine your living room, feel your clothes. For thousands of years, we have searched nature to satisfy our hunger, cure our diseases, build our houses, and make our lives more comfortable, Antonelli writes in the report's introduction. But our early exploration of useful traits in the species relied on rudimentary tools, and indigenous knowledge was lost as local traditions were downplayed and globalization emerged, he adds. As a result, humanity is still a long way from utilizing the full potential of biodiversity, in particular plants and fungi, which play critical roles in ecosystems. Now, more than ever before, we need to explore the solutions they could provide to the global challenges we face. The report comes on the heels of a United Nations assessment that the international community has failed to fulfill any of the biodiversity targets that were set a decade ago, as well as the latest edition of Worldwide Fund for Nature's flagship publication, which warned that nature, our life support system, is declining at a staggering rate. Specifically, WWF found an average 68% decrease in population sizes of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish between 1970 and 2016. Throughout the report's 12 chapters, researchers address the importance of seeking out species before they disappear and calculating extinction risks, ways that plants and fungi can be used in terms of food, energy, healthcare, and more, how biological resources can be used more wisely, and the conditions in the UK and its territories. Natural ecosystems provide the useful services for humanity, such as regulating climate, preventing floods, and filtering water. As the building blocks of ecosystems, plants and fungi have the potential to help us address current environmental challenges, such as climate change, the report notes. However, these natural benefits could be compromised by biodiversity loss caused by humans clearing or degrading natural vegetation and overharvesting wild species, as well as by shifting weather patterns. Given the importance of plants and fungi, we need to have a rough idea of the conservation status of every species.
Imar Nice, Lugada conservation scientist at RBGQ and lead author of Extinction Chapter, explained in a statement. Lugada highlighted advancements with artificial intelligence, adding, "The techniques are good enough to say this area has a lot of species that haven't been assessed but are almost certainly threatened." In 2019 alone, 1,942 plants and 1,8800 fungi were scientifically named for the first time, according to the report, which adds that current threats to global biodiversity from climate change, logging, and land use change make the task of cataloging species a race against time. Only 6 species of medicinal fungi have been assessed for conservation status, one of which, Phomitopsis, a wood-inhabiting parasitic fungus, has already been pushed to the brink of extinction, the report says. Out of 25,791 known medicinal plants, 5,411 have been assessed and 723, or 13%, are threatened. Professor Monique Simmons, Deputy Director of Science at RBGQ and lead author of the commercialization chapter, told The Guardian that humanity should look to nature for treating coronavirus and other diseases with pandemic potential. As she put it, "I'm absolutely sure going forward that some of the leads for the next generation of drugs in this area will come from plants and fungi." The report also notes that even though there are at least 7,039 plants that hold potential as foods, just 15 crop plants contribute to 90% of humanity's energy intake, and more than 4 billion people rely on just rice, maize, and wheat. As an RBGQ statement explained, relying on a handful of crops to feed the global population has contributed to malnutrition and left us vulnerable to climate change. Stefano Padulosi, co-author of Food Chapter, said, "The thousands of underutilized and neglected plant species are the lifeline to millions of people on Earth, tormented by unprecedented climate change, pervasive food and nutrition insecurity, and economic disempowerment. Harnessing this basket of untapped resources for making food and production systems more diverse and resilient to change should be our moral duty to current and future generations," declared Padulosi, former senior scientist at the Alliance of Biodiversity International and the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. Antonelli agreed, saying broadly that the data emerging from this year's report paints a picture of a world that has turned its back on the potential of plants and fungi to address fundamental global issues such as food security and climate change. "Societies have been too dependent on too few species for so long. At a time of rapid biodiversity loss, we are failing to access the treasure chest of incredible diversity on offer and missing a huge opportunity for our generation," he added. "As we start the most critical decade our planet has ever faced, we hope this report will give the public, businesses, and policymakers the